Games and Libraries podcast for October 2008. Welcome to the Games and Libraries podcast, and this episode is all about doing your own gaming program. We know with National Gaming Day coming up, we wanted to talk a little bit about that and then give you some of the basics that you need to put together a gaming program. So we're going to start out with Jenny Levine talking about what National Game at Your Library Day is on November 15th. And then Beth Galloway will come and talk a little bit about facilities for running a gaming program. Eli Nyberger will provide a lot of details for those of you wanting to run a video game tournament. And I will talk about board games and how to select and run board games in your library. And then finally, Kelly Zarnecki will talk about something a little different, and that is how to run a program that encourages people to do game design. That's something she's been doing. Now, if you're listening to this and you're brand new to running a gaming program, this is going to give you a lot of good stuff. If you already know your stuff, then tell someone else about it. Or even if you don't know your stuff, tell someone else about it. This is a great episode for someone who's brand new to gaming and libraries to listen and get a handle on how to get started, because that's the goal. So, without further ado, let's introduce Jenny.
Hi, this is Jenny Levine with the American Library Association, and today I'm going to tell you a little bit about our upcoming event, National Gaming Day at Your Library. This is going to take place on November 15th, which is a Saturday, and our goal here is to bring games and gaming to libraries across the U.S. so that everyone has the opportunity to read, learn, and play at their library. We also want to increase awareness of gaming activities in libraries and help educate parents about the benefits of different types of games so that they can make informed decisions about using games in their own homes. So what exactly is going to happen on Gaming Day? Well, we have a couple of parallel activities. The first is going to be a national video game tournament, which Eli is going to talk about. And the basics for that are that we're going to have a Dance Dance Revolution tournament and a Rock Band tournament. And those will run throughout the day on the 15th. In addition, we'll have a Super Smash Bros. Brawl playoff, which will take place at a specific time, 3 p.m. Eastern. Now, while this is going on, we're also going to do a parallel board game activity, because we believe gaming is not just about video games and libraries, and libraries actually have a long history of offering board and classic games as part of their programming. Thanks to a very generous donation from Hasbro that was arranged by Shytag, every public library in the country is going to receive a free copy of the board game Pictureka in the mail. Now, what this will allow us to do is to arrange gameplay for November 15th throughout the day, because what we want to do is set a record for the most number of people playing a board game on the same day. You'll also find in that mailing some mini packs for a game called Top Trumps, which is kind of an educational version of the game War, the card game War. So watch for those. In addition, and this applies to any type of library, not just public libraries, if you go to icanhas.com/NGD, which will be in the show notes on the website for the podcast, you can sign up to receive a free Magic Gathering kit or a Dungeons & Dragons starter kit from Wizards of the Coast. So again, we'd like to thank Wizards for this generous donation. The key is that you have to be one of the first 1,000 libraries to sign up for this before October 27th. So make sure you go to icanhaz.com/NGD to sign up for this free offer. So what this gives you is at least 3 games that you can offer for programming so you can your library and your patrons can participate in National Gaming Day. And then if you have video games that you can play, including games that are not part of the national tournament, we encourage you to do that as well. There is a media toolkit available on the ALA website to help you do some PR for this event. And if you go to our gaming resources site, which is gaming.ala.org/resources, you can find out more about National Gaming Day and grab a logo to use on your own materials. So that's an overview of the day, and we certainly hope your library will participate. Be sure to use the sign-up form to tell us if you're participating so that we can put you on the map of libraries. If your library hasn't offered gaming programming before, be sure to listen to the rest of our podcast because we have several experts who are going to give you lots of great advice and tips on how to do this. One of the great things about gaming is that you can start small and scale it up as you have the resources. So you don't have to expend a lot of staff time or budget in order to be able to do these types of events. And that's another reason that we've helped coordinate this donation from Hasbro. We're very excited about this opportunity, and we hope to see you on the map of participating libraries. If you have any questions as you're moving forward, please don't hesitate to contact me at jlevine@ala.org. And in the meantime, be sure to keep updated on our gaming news blog at gaming.ala.org/news. Thanks, and have a great day on the 15th.
This is Beth Galloway, and I'm going to talk about gaming facilities. Room size really isn't the dictator of the kind of gaming experience you're able to deliver. Above all, we want a space with portable furniture, electricity, and a variety of lighting. We want the ability to dim lights near screens or brighten them for tabletop gaming. Access to the restrooms or kitchen is always a plus. If you're thinking about food, you may want to have it in a separate area. If that isn't possible, consider offering food before or after the program. If you're determined to have it during the session, think carefully about the type of food you're providing. Everyone may love to eat pizza, but that can result in greasy controllers or stained cards. Clear liquids are less likely to stain clothing and rugs. Pretzels, popcorn, and cookies are crumbly, but easy to clean up. Make sure you provide a waste paper basket and recycling bins. Have a broom or dust buster on hand. Provide plenty of napkins. Offer hand sanitizer. This does double duty in cold season. Baby wipes are also a good solution. I personally use Clorox bleach wipes to sanitize all of my equipment after each program. Board, card, and dice games may require tables and be better suited to a meeting room, classroom, children's program or craft room, or even the study tables near your reference desk. A seat for every player is a must. Tables should be well lit and equipped with pencils and scrap paper for scorekeeping. Alternatively, you can use white paper tablecloths, rolls of newsprint, or butcher paper as a tablecloth, and then people can keep score right on that paper cloth. If you're thinking about a LAN party, you need to consider the structure of your library's computer network. A school or college library with a large lab may be very well suited to this and able to provide access to 30 or more participants. A speedy internet connection and computers with fast processors, plenty of RAM, and good video cards are really a must. If you're concerned that your facility's computers are not up to par for role-playing, shooting, or racing games online, you can invite patrons to bring in their own laptops or PCs and hook them up, wired or wirelessly, to your local area network that's separate from the one where all of your staff computers are connected. LAN parties can be structured, such as a formal game design workshop, questing in RuneScape or World of Warcraft on specific servers, or Halo tournaments where specific players play at specific times. They can also be very unstructured, simply provide a web page with a list of recommended games, or a go-at-your-own-pace game design class. If you're providing video games, check the screens you intend to use ahead of time. Look for RCA cable input in the back or on the side. You're looking for three holes, each one rimmed in a different color. Yellow is for video, red and white are for audio. If you just have yellow and white holes, don't panic. It just means you might not get stereo sound. If the audio jack is rimmed in black, though, you may need an adapter from a place like Radio Shack. It'll just cost you a couple of dollars. The main goal is really to make the gaming experience bigger and better than home gameplay. Putting video games on a big screen is just one way to do this. If you can borrow a projector, maybe from your regional library system, a school, the AV department, or a local business, you can save yourself a little bit of money. But consider, for just about $1,000, you can buy your own projector. It sounds like a lot of money to start with, but don't forget you can use it for several different types of programs in a week. Not just gaming, but to show movies, to do training for your staff or community for karaoke. It's really a great investment. And our wiki at gaming.ala.org/resources has a spot with a list of some gaming-compatible projectors. Video games and equipment may require tables or carts to hold projectors and consoles. Players may need chairs to sit on, or just to store controllers on. Some people like to play Guitar Hero standing up, others sitting down, others still sitting in one chair with their feet propped up on another. Do bear in mind that consoles left permanently in public spaces should really be in a locked storage unit, which several different library companies provide. In terms of space, Dance Dance Revolution is an active game, and that might require a little bit more room than Super Smash Bros., which could be played while seated. Rock Band is a 4-player rhythm game with a 3-foot-long drum kit, so that takes a little bit of space in and of itself. I usually advise 9 to 12 square feet per player for rhythm games, like Dance Dance Revolution, Guitar Hero, and Rock Band, and 4 to 6 square feet per player for seated kinds of games. Don't forget to leave additional space for spectators or for background singers and dances. Chairs should be kept at a distance to encourage waiting in line for a turn and participatory watching. Keep seating on hand for those who just came to watch or hang out, though. Maybe in the corners, maybe along the sides. In almost every program I've done, I've had at least one person sit in the corner and read a book, or simply sit to text a friend. Gaming on handheld devices might be a good solution for smaller libraries. Participants can spread out in the library after hours, flop on beanbag chairs in a teen area, sit together in a meeting room or classroom, or sit on cushions or rug squares in a storytime room. With a Nintendo DS, players within 30 feet of one another can connect and share games without any internet connection required. If you truly feel that your library is just too small, you could consider holding an after-hours program. You can host multiple board or video games spread out in different areas of the library. Staffing, of course, could be an issue, so offering a multi-generational program hosted by staff from different departments may be a solution. It also may be a family gaming type of environment, which means you're going to have a little bit more help with adults paying attention to kids and what they're doing, and maybe giving you a hand with crowd management or behavior management. Think outside of the box. The session doesn't actually have to be held at your location to be branded as a library program. Consider bringing your games to a senior center or nursing home, city hall auditorium, school cafeteria, YMCA, girls or boys club, a church basement, a local college, or other space in the community. Having your program outside of the library allows for cross-marketing and may even be a partnership opportunity. You can work with one of these hosting organizations to share the equipment and resources. When I think about limiting participation, fire code is only one aspect. I also think about timing. I suggest games with short rounds, 3 to 10 minutes, to allow for more turns per player. In an hour, you'll generally get through 6 to 8 rounds of a rhythm racing or fighting game. Multiply the number of rounds times the number of players in the game. Usually 2 for DDR or Guitar Hero, 4 for Brawl, Mario Kart, or Rock Band. And this will give you a general idea of how many people can play in an hour. A good rule of thumb that allows for multiple turns throughout your session is to have about 1 console for every 12 participants, or 1 board or card game for every 6 participants. For LAN parties, it's pretty much 1 person per computer. For handheld devices, it's often 1 device per person. If you are doing a bring-your-own program, where people bring in their own computers or handheld devices, consider having a few house devices. Those are ones that the library owns and will loan out to folks who don't have their own equipment. For a tournament, remember it can take a long time to get through all of the players, so don't register more competitors than you have time or space for. Try to provide additional activities for those eliminated early. Timing is also a consideration for board and card games. Take a look at the instructions in advance. It tells you how many players, whether people need to play on teams, and often there's a time estimation for how long it takes to complete a full game. So you can use that to plan accordingly. Monopoly may be a crowd favorite, but it's much more conducive to an all-day weekend session, perhaps, than a two-hour board game night. Remember that whatever the size and type of your library, you can provide a gaming experience to your community. Your imagination, not the size of the facility, is the only limit.
Hey, how's it going? It's Eli, and today we're going to talk about one of my very favorite things, how to run a tournament. Now, if you're already doing any gaming at all, you may have tried an open play event, or you may be planning on doing an open play event where, you know, you just have the machine set up and you have some games there and the kids come and play. And that's great. It's a great way to get started and get kids coming into the library and playing video games and understanding kind of a different view of what libraries can mean to them. However, it's not adding all that much value onto it other than the fact that they are getting to play with people who they wouldn't otherwise get to play with. And really, when you get down to it, the best way to add value to the experience of playing a video game is to make a tournament out of it, make a competitive event. And it can always be a little bit tricky because libraries are not always comfortable with the notion of competition. Even though we are comfortable with the concept of games and even summer reading games that have prizes and things like that, sometimes it can be really hard to get people comfortable with the idea of taking that leap from open play to tournament events, especially because tournaments can be complex affairs. And there's lots of different ways to handle the complexity of it. The best is to rely upon your audience of players, your community of players, as a way to help make those decisions that would otherwise be difficult to make, especially if you're not a gamer yourself or if you're not familiar with the game that you're playing. But the most important thing as you're starting up a gaming program is for you as a library staff person or whoever is involved that is acting as the responsible adult in the room to realize that you have to maintain the authority. And this is, of course, authority is something that libraries usually love, but it is important to see yourself not just as judge, jury, and executioner, but also as referee, umpire, facilitator, moderator, president, ringleader, all that stuff. Because even if you hand over control of the event to the kids, which is a really great way to approach it, if you're concerned about your own knowledge, it needs to be clear who's in charge so that you can avoid allowing a single group or a single type of gamer to dominate the event and tilt it in their favor. Now, in most circumstances, that's not going to happen, but you need to know enough about the games, enough about the events to set the goals for the players so that the people who are constructing the event and coming up with the rule sets are trying to achieve the same goals that you are, not working across purposes. So we'll talk a little bit more about that later, but first let's talk about the basics of running a tournament. One thing that I always like to stress is that it's important to have some form of pre-registration for your players. Now, this can take a lot of different forms, but the goal is to have some way by which the kids who are really excited about this event can formally declare their intent to defeat all other noobs in the area, and because they're not going to be able to relax about the event until they're able to tell you that they're coming. Similarly, their parents aren't going to be able to tell them that they have to shut up about it until they're able to tell their kid, look, I signed you up already, so shut up. Now, that list of pre-registrants is essentially useless once the event actually begins, because half of them aren't going to show up, and half the people who are show up aren't going to be on the list, and you should always try to set up these events so that you don't have to turn anyone away unless you absolutely have to. And part of handling pre-registration in a smart way means that don't limit your pre-registration, because then you will limit it to kids who aren't actually going to even show up. If you cut it off at 80 people, you know, and I think many of you are probably 80 people, oh my God, but if you limit your registration to 80 people and you turn people away after that, only 40 of those 80 are actually going to show up, and you turned 40 people away before the event even began. So try not to cap your pre-registration, but always try to have some form of it so that they can declare their intent to come to the event and relax about it. Now, after you've done your registration, then when the event actually opens the doors, I always like to kind of open the doors at least half an hour before the event, assuming that it's happening in a room that has doors. Sometimes you might consider doing this after hours, especially if you're a small library without a program room, as starting a gaming service after hours, if that's on the table, can be a much easier way to get the service started, and you can sidestep a lot of the issues such as the newspaper people being upset about the noisy kids actually being in the library. They're supposed to be seen, not heard, all that stuff. So regardless, it's always nice to expect that the kids are going to show up early. And if you have a room, it's nice to have stuff set up and be able to open the doors in advance, because that beginning part of the event when the kids are coming in is a very important part for them to size each other up, socialize, meet new players without the stress of the tournament itself happening. And it's a good kind of stress. But you should also be sure not to ever start the actual tournament itself less than half an hour after the time you publicized it was going to happen. because you need to allow kids to have time to be late, because there are some times during a tournament when you can't add someone else fairly. And basically that point is, once someone has been eliminated, there's no way to add someone new. And it's difficult because most library events you can walk into no matter how late it is and not be a problem. At the teen events, we usually walk a pretty hard line with that. Once you have been eliminated, there's not a chance to, once someone has been eliminated, you can't get back into that event. However, when we do events for younger kids, we usually will only use half of our equipment to actually do the tournaments. The other half of the equipment can be open play throughout the entire event. That way, no matter what time little kids come, they can still come and play, and that's a helpful thing. All right, so you got to check people in as they come in. You know, it's helpful to refer to that pre-registration, but honestly, I just completely ignore the pre-registration list once the event actually starts and have everyone check in, because if they pre-registered, they still got to let you know that they're actually there, and you're going to have a lot of people there who didn't register at all. So you want to be as welcoming as possible to them. While they're checking in, you just let them do some open play. Space on a machine is scarce, you know, if you don't have a lot of consoles available to them, what you'll want to do is allow them or encourage them to turn over quickly. Like, say, winner stays. That's all you got to say. Winner stays. So when people play a match, the winner gets to stay. Everyone else has to get up and let someone else have a turn. Because during that warm-up period, kids are going to not necessarily be as charitably minded as they might otherwise be. Although, again, it depends on how you structure the event. Once you're getting close to half hour after the event was supposed to begin, you're going to need to build the brackets. Now, brackets can take a lot of different forms. I always try to start an event off with a qualification round, meaning that everyone gets a certain number of matches before anyone is eliminated. That way, everyone gets a few turns, no one's knocked out in the first round. But that's a lot easier when you have more than one station at which kids can play games. If you only have one, you might need to start off with a single elimination tournament, which we'll get to in a minute. But if you don't have a lot of kids, or if you have a couple different machines that they can play on, then you'll want to have structure your tournaments that everyone gets a certain number of qualification matches before anyone's eliminated. Now, to determine how long your qualification round is going to take, you basically need to multiply the number of players times the number of matches you'd like each player to have, usually two or three. Then you divide that by the number of simultaneous players that you can handle. So, you know, if you can handle four players at a time and you have 12 kids there and they each want to have three matches, 12 times three is 36, divided by four players at a time, that's nine rounds of play that you need to get through. So you need to figure out how long each cycle takes, how long it takes for players to play their match and for the next ones to sit down. So nine times your cycle time tells you the total number of minutes that your whole round is going to take. That can be challenging because you're not in control of all those variables. You can't really control the number of players unless you cut it off. You can control the number of matches per players. You can't really control the number of simultaneous players unless you have more machines that you can throw at it. You can control the cycle time, the amount of time that each round takes, but it depends on the game. Some games it's really easy to control. Super Smash Brothers, you just set how long each match takes, for example. Mario Kart, not so easy. So it depends on what game you're playing, which of those variables are under control, and depending on how hard the end time of your tournament window is, you may need to be conservative here so that you're not running over. It really sucks to be running over and have to change the tournament at the last minute to be able to get it done before the library closes. So once you've figured out how many qualifying rounds you're going to have, it's important to randomize how players get seeded into those qualifying rounds so they're not playing against the same four people each time they come up. There's lots of different ways to approach it. If you use GT system or scoring a tournament system that's online, I'll talk more about that at the end. But if you use GT system, it'll take care of that for you. Now, once everyone has had all their qualifying rounds, remember you need to keep score as each player gets their qualifying rounds. In some games, it's easier than others, but generally we use a system where first place gets 100 points and last place gets 10 points, and then it's balanced out in between. That way, it's pretty easy to keep track of who is winning after everyone's had a number of matches, and you've got some people who had first, second, thirds, all kinds of different places. It's relatively easy to extract who's doing the best out of that and decide who's going to move on to the elimination round. Now, for single elimination, you need to have a power of two players, which means 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64 players moving on to elimination. What we tend to do at our tournaments is everyone gets three rounds, then the top 32 players advance to single elimination. If you don't have a power of two players, you can still use a bracket that has that many slots, but you can pad it out with buys. And, there's some good resources for that on the web just to get brackets that you can download into Microsoft Word. There's a Dart site that has a lot of great single elimination brackets. You can just download them and print them out and fill it out. It makes it a very easy way to do it. Just remember, if you don't start with a power of two slots in your bracket, it's not going to work out right at the end. However, sometimes before you get into this point with the elimination, you'll probably need to have a tiebreaker. For example, if you're taking your top 16 on and you've got a tie for 15th place between three people, that means only two of those three people who are all have the same score get to move on. So you have to have a tiebreaker. Most important thing for tiebreakers is that everyone who is tied has an equal opportunity to move on. There's lots of different ways to do it. When in doubt, ask the kids. It's a general safe rule of thumb. Okay, so once you start your single elimination, it's important to keep in mind, again, if you're trying to finish on time, that you will require the number of matches to finish a single elimination as the number of competitors that you have minus one. So if you take a 16, if you take 16 players on to a single elimination head-to-head bracket, you're going to have to play 15 matches before you're done. If you have more than one machine, you can play more than one match simultaneously, but sometimes you can't move on to the next round until the previous round of elimination is complete. So it's something to keep in mind, again, as you're making that plan. One thing that I've found very helpful is I always tell the kids that I hope to take the top 16 or the top 32 players onto elimination, but that if we get crunched for time, we may only be able to take the top 8 players onto elimination, because that gives you a way to cut the elimination section in half. It's not as much fun for the kids who come, but when that closing of the library is bearing down on you and you got to get it done in time, it's a real easy time saver to be able to keep that moving. Now, when you get down to your final four players, that's your semifinals. You have them in two groups of two. They each play each other. The winners go to the first place match. The losers go to the third place match, also called the consolation match. So in the first place match, the winner takes your first prize. The loser takes second prize. In the consolation match, the winner takes third prize. The loser takes fourth prize. Now, prizes don't have to be fancy, but you need to have something, even if it's just a candy bar. It can't be a bookmark. It has to be something of immediately perceived value, even its very low perceived value. And the one rule of thumb is you can always increase the value of your prizes, but you can never decrease them because the kids will remember. So keep that in mind. Now, it can be really tricky to set up what the kids call a rule set for your tournament, because it can be difficult, if you don't know anything about the game, to make the right choices and come up with a rule set that's mutually beneficial and fair. So this is where you really want to find some advisors, whether among the kids or someone on staff or, you know, a knowledgeable child or grandchild or any one of those kinds of things. You need to find someone who's knowledgeable about these games who you can bounce it off of, or you need to entrust the entire event to the kids to produce and let them make all those decisions. The most important thing when you do that is be sure to set out the goals for them. Here are the things that I want you guys to do. And one of those rules needs to be you need to make a tournament that is fair to both experienced and beginning players. That's a very important thing for a library to do, because you don't want to allow the kids to insist upon a hardcore friendly rule set, because a lot of times they will. They'll want the rules to bias toward the kids who are really serious competitors, which makes it really difficult for the casual kids to ever have a chance. And that's not, I always say to them that, you know, I like to have hope at the library. I want kids who haven't played this game before to have some hope, even a tiny hope, of beating a superior player. But of course, the superior players want there to be no hope of them ever being defeated by a inferior specimen of the species. So one of the best things you can do whenever you get a question, how should we do this? What's this, you know, when someone asks you, what's this picayune little detail? What decision are you going to make? And you have no idea what they're talking about. Just turn around and say, I don't know. Should we allow legendary Pokemon? Or, you know, ask them the question and they're going to sound off for the next 10 minutes about how it should go. One of the very best things that you can do, and I've probably said that six times already, but a great thing is to have a blog. And if you just get a blogger blog to promote your events, if you sign up for GT System, it includes blog posts that the kids can participate in. That blog gives you a live focus group, an immediate opportunity to vet any of your ideas, and a place for them to hash out these discussions before the event begins, because you don't want to get stuck in the minutiae of how the game's going to be set up in the middle of a live event. So you got to find those advisors, whether they're in person, whether it's on the blog. You will need to have some sort of a group of kids who you trust, who you can count on to inform you about what are the best decisions to be made for these games, because these games have very robust rule sets. They're extremely complex entertainments, and it takes a lot of knowledge to be able to make the right decisions. And so long as you explain to them what the goals are and make it clear to them that they're not going to be able to pull a fast one on you, then you'll have a really great relationship with them. And it's always important to include them in the decision making and think of it as you're running an event with them, not for them. One of the best ways to do that is when kids say, how come we can't play Halo? We want to play Halo. And, you know, without really getting into the fact that you know, it's certainly a double standard to say no Halo at the library because it's not any more violent than tons of things that we have in our collections. Leaving that aside, most libraries would be uncomfortable with running a Halo event, and for some very good reasons. But when the kids say, how come we can't have a Halo tournament, you don't say, look, children, this game is rated M and you're all too little and we can't let you little kids play this big, tough game. That's not the way to change their expectations of what the library. What I always say is, look, guys, I'd love to do a Halo tournament, but I don't want someone's mom to shut us down. They all have familiarity with other parents who aren't, as they see it, reasonable about video games. And instead of saying, sorry, kids, this isn't for you, you're saying, look, we would all like to do this, but it's not going to work for us because it comes at a cost to our community. And I think that that's a way to bring them in, help them understand that they're a part of this too, and not just shut them out and make decisions for them. One final note that I want to say, this is my number one rule for having a tournament. You must always know when the next one will be. Always. Because that's the number one question you're going to get. When are you doing this again? And if you don't have an answer, there's a chance that kid's not going to come back. So even if your answer is 6 months from now, watch for our brochure in April, you have to have an answer to that question. Because if they come up and say, you know, this is so awesome, when are you doing the next one? You say, oh, I don't know, it's just a pilot, we're not sure, we're going to see how it goes. You know, not only do you have the possibility of them not coming back, but you're signaling them, we're trying this really cool thing for you, but we're not sure we're really going to do it. And that's not the signal that you want to send for them. So always, always know when your next event is going to be. More importantly, if you can plan an ongoing series of events, whether they're months apart, weeks apart, whatever, it will be easier to promote and you will get growth from one event to another. It's not something you can do a trial balloon to see how it works because you're reaching new customers and they're not going to come in the first time. You've got to position the event as a series that can grow over time, give word of mouth time to spread. And that's the most important thing you can do to make your tournament a success. If you're interested in finding out more about GT System, it's our online web service that allows you to do tournament management, including brackets and leaderboards and clans and blog posts and polls and all kinds of stuff. You can find out more at wiki.gtsystem.org, or you can email us at gtsystem@aadl.org, and we can give you some more information about the system. We'll be using it to run a Brawl tournament on National Gaming Day. We'll also be using it to keep score of DDR and Rock Band tournaments on National Gaming Day. So if you have questions about that, please feel free to contact us, and we'll help get you signed up. Thanks a lot for your interest, and hope to see you online. Take it easy.
Hi there, it's Scott Nicholson again, here to talk about board games. Now, board games have been the area of gaming I have explored most heavily, and I'll just plug right here. If you want to learn about 52 different board games, head over to BoardGamesWithScott.com. I've got videos that teach you how to play many of them. I've been helping the local Fayetteville Public Library run their gaming events over the summer and have learned a lot about what sort of board games work well and what don't work so well in the sort of two-hour gaming program. As mentioned earlier, something like Monopoly, while a lot of people know it and know how to play it, the problem is it takes far too long. And what I've learned is that in this setting where you've got a video game going over there and a tournament going over there, that the sort of games that work well in tabletop games are ones that are easy to learn and play relatively quickly. And so either games that people know already or things that can be taught fairly quickly work well. Now, something to remember is if you are going to have games that need to be taught, you're going to have a library staff member in the area to teach the games. One trick I've learned with that is that if you put out two copies of the same game next to each other and you get one group going on it, if another group sits down, you can then get them going, and they have the first group to ask questions of. And then when the first group is finished and leaves and a new group comes on, the process will continue. And so if you can get two copies of these games that you're going to use, that can help you out a lot. Now, things I look at in these games are, how well does it scale with different numbers of people? How easily is it to play if you don't have all the pieces? How fast is it to play one round? Can you walk away after a round? How inexpensive is the game? How easy is it to get? And so I've provided a list in the show notes over at gamesandlibraries.org of some games I would recommend you consider for your games and libraries. Now, you're all getting a copy of Picturica, and I'm going to be doing a video on how to play that game. You should have a letter that comes with Picturica, and that'll point you to the letter. But also that will be in the show notes is the location of that video. So when you put out games, you want to think of a few things. You want to think about satisfying different gaming interests. And so, for example, Pictureka is going to be a light party-type game that will work well with kids and adults together. Wits and Wagers is a great light trivia game that's a series of rounds that works well for slightly older kids and adults. Something like Blockus is a very popular game. Its disadvantages are that if you lose pieces, it doesn't work as well, and that you can only play with two or four successfully. There's a three-player variant. It's not particularly good. But a lot of people know how to play it and will run over to play it because it's a very fun game. It plays very quickly. That's a great little game. Something new to check out at your local Target is Sorry Sliders. This is a dexterity game where it's kind of like a shuffleboard game. It'll play up to four people, and I've been having a lot of fun with this one. This has been one of my new finds. Now, if you have people that want to play things like Monopoly or Clue, but you don't want to have a game experience that takes that long, you might want to check out the new Express lines of games. Monopoly Express is a press-your-luck dice-rolling game, kind of like a Yahtzee game, but it plays quite quickly. Clue Express is a dice-based clue game where each turn you're rolling dice and taking a guess. It's a lot simpler to play, and so those are both games that you can play in about 20 minutes and get experiences like Clue, and then Monopoly Express is not at all like Monopoly, other than it's themed in the same thing, but it's a press-your-luck dice game. So I'm not going to continue to rattle off titles. Check my show notes to see much more of the games I would recommend. But one thing I will warn you about are snacks. You want to consider the effect of greasy fingers on snacks on board games. That can be a real issue with games. Another issue can be drinks. Even with water, if water gets spilled on a board game, it can ruin it because many of the board games are made of cardboard. Now, another thing to consider, having some card games out. A lot of people know how to play Uno. They like how to play Uno. So you might want to have out Uno as a card game. That one always seems to get a good amount of use. Just regular decks of cards can also be useful. A game that uses cards is called Apples to Apples. It's a light party game. A lot of people know how to play that one, and that one's a fun game. So having a combination of board and card games that help meet the needs of many different types of users. Big piece of advice, have the stuff out. Have it where you have set it up, where you're ready to teach the rules. If it's just all piled up in boxes, people are not going to get into it. Instead, what you want to do is make it like Christmas morning. They come down, the games are spread out, and you're ready to teach them. You may have to do some shepherding. If you see a bunch of folks standing around the DDR game, go over and say, hey, I've got this game show type board game. If anyone wants to give it a shot, it's all set up, and it only takes a few minutes to learn and bring people over. I find you may have to help move people around, especially if it's a game they haven't seen before. Now, I'm going to be creating some assessment tools for National Gaming Day, as well as beyond, where you'll be able to log who's playing what games at every half-hour interval. And this is going to be very useful to us in understanding what games are popular and what games aren't. For this particular event, it's important for us to log how many people play Pictureka on this day. That's an important number to capture. But what I'd like you to do is every half an hour, look around the room, note down how many people are engaged with each of your gaming areas and what games they're playing. That's going to be useful to us in understanding what's going on with games and libraries. So that's enough of me going on about board games. Check the show notes for more information, and I'll talk to you later.
Hi, this is Kelly Zarnicki, and my podcast today is on Gaming Programs 101. Recently, I attended a workshop that took place in the gym of a local university. Over 1,000 middle and high schoolers were there during the school day, and they came to hear from faculty from all around the state and local people, including the mayor, the school superintendent, people from the Chamber of Commerce, and more. Before the presentations, the youth were given time to explore information at various booths, which were mostly about classes that they could take for careers related to gaming and game design. The clear emphasis on the presentations was that students need to have math and science skills if they really want to pursue any kind of career even remotely related to gaming. Advertising your library's tutoring help on and offline in this context might just get more teens to take part in and make the connection that it's important to a goal they want to achieve. I'm going to talk a bit about organizing a video game design program in the context of the library. I have used several different game design programs at my public library at various times of the year. I have offered it during the summer when many camps from organizations in the community visit, as an after-school program during the school year, inside of a school as part of an after-school program, and in relationship to YALSA's Teen Read Week and YALSA's Teen Tech Week. A few pieces of advice that I would share include the following. There are many free game design sites that exist. As posted on a recent discussion by LibGaming Google Group's listserv, the following were mentioned. Sims Carnival, Spore Creature Creator, Ben 10 Alien Force, Scratch, Alice, Game Maker, Adrift, Drawn to Life, Adventure Maker, and RPG Maker. And I'll include all of the URLs for these in the source notes. The second tip is, I know this might sound silly, but I found that the approach in teaching the software depends as much, if not more, on the software itself that is being used. Consider holding the workshops in a variety of different ways if the first approach doesn't seem to work the best. Maybe it's the software, or maybe it's something else. For example, create an idea for a game. It doesn't have to be anything elaborate that you would like them to try and make. Better yet, of course, have them come up with the idea, but if they're needing a little bit of nudge, this might be the direction you want to go. And then make the creation of it like a game itself. So have the kids win points by figuring out the different steps that go into making the particular game that the whole class has decided on. The other thing that I found is the availability of access to the software makes a difference. Again, this might sound obvious, but at my library, we usually teach our classes in a computer lab, but the openness of the lab is dependent on staff availability. We allow programs such as Photoshop and Dreamweaver to be on the public computers. Why not game design programs as well? And of course, thinking about it, sometimes once they get introduced to the software, you know, depending on their level, their interests, that it's less of teaching a class and, of course, facilitating and guiding the class. So that even puts less emphasis being necessary to have it in the computer lab versus on the public computers as well. The next thing is don't feel you have to master everything in the program before you're able to offer it as a class. Sure, you want to learn as much as you can, but don't be horrified if someone in your class has a question that you can't answer right away. It's okay. Encouraging teamwork with others in the class to solve the problem, as well as communicating on the forums boards, if they exist, with others, can go a long way toward empowering them in the future when they have a question and you're just not around to help them answer it. And the last tip I have fun with it, keep learning new skills with the software, keep trying out new software, and advertising its availability at the library as well as to other librarians who could benefit from it as well. Thanks.
Well, you've reached the end of another Games and Libraries podcast. Thanks for joining us, and I hope you decide to try out some gaming in your library. More about this podcast and more episodes and more stuff can be found over at gamesandlibraries.org. We'd like to thank the Verizon Foundation for their sponsorship of this podcast.